This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you, maybe right down the street, maybe they're your neighbors, but they have incredible stories of the things that they've done for the sake of our freedom. And we don't want to forget that. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a whole lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and oftentimes inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And I think you might be blown away by the connection at the end of this one today. But let's start early on with Harold Lowe, 88 years old. Las Vegas, Nevada is where he lives now, but Peoria, Illinois, growing up. And that was the quintessential American hometown. What was it like growing up there in Peoria?
Well, Peoria was a town that was dominated by blue-collar workers. Caterpillar Tractor dominated the scene. During the first part of World War II, I actually worked part-time at Caterpillar after school.
Hmm.
They had a special bus that picked us up and took us to the factory. We worked weekends also, so we worked after school as well, and it was quite fulfilling to me because I was involved with athletics as well as the schoolwork, and I was a junior class president, felt an obligation not only to my class, but to the country.
Well, and I want to talk about that, and you were seeking to fulfill that obligation long before you became a U.S. Marine and long before you ended up with a Purple Heart. But you're growing up in Peoria. You're a big Cubs fan. Gabby Hartnett's your favorite player. You love listening to him on the radio. But I imagine in December of 1941, you heard something besides baseball on the radio that changed your perspective a little bit. What do you remember about December 7th and finding out that the Japanese had attacked? How'd you hear?
Well, we heard it by radio, and believe it or not, there was a tavern open where next to the barber shop. And I was to get a free haircut. You paid for 5 haircuts, and then you got a free one. I think it was 20 cents or something like that.
Uh-huh.
But at any rate, the people in the tavern heard on the radio, and they came out exclaiming, you know, we're at war, and we've been attacked, and so forth. And I'll always remember that day.
I imagine you would. And you're just a teenager, what, 15 years old, I guess, at the time, huh?
Yes.
Did it rock your world a little bit? Was it a big eye-opener?
It was a very big eye-opener because my father was a veteran of World War I, and we marched in parades and so forth as sons of the VFW. And being patriotic at that time was not only in most of the families, but there wasn't much of a division like there is today with so many different people wanting the whole world to see it their way.
We could learn from that quite a bit, couldn't we?
Yes.
You mentioned your father being a World War I veteran. Did he ever tell you much about what he did during that time period?
No. I know he received a Purple Heart, which I sent on to my son Tommy along with mine. And I know he was a sergeant and he was a Browning machine gunner.
Uh-huh.
And he got wounded in the leg.
Somewhere in France, probably?
Yes, in France. It was in the Argonne Forest in France. The wound was pretty serious. It took him out of action until the end of the war. He was still in France, so.
Well, and I guess when you understand that, you probably feel pretty fortunate to be alive yourself, huh? Because if he didn't come home from that, you wouldn't be here.
That's true. That's very true. But at that young age, it was only after I got into the service that I realized what war was really like.
I imagine so. And I imagine your kids and grandkids feel pretty fortunate to be here themselves once they know what you went through during the war. But so you experience Pearl Harbor. This emotion behind your patriotism swells. And you said you went to work at the Caterpillar factory?
Yes, in East Peoria.
And so that was war-related duty?
That was war industry, and it was very tough. It was outside in the yards at Caterpillar where we took big idler wheels and put them on skids and took them to the machinery buildings and so forth.
That was for farm equipment, or was this for, like, tanks and stuff?
This was for tanks and stuff.
Okay.
Yeah, the farm equipment was out of the window until after the war.
And I don't know if people really realize that, but all of American industry really shifted into war mode. So things that might have been available before, for instance, automakers had a hard time getting metal for cars. But so here's a farm equipment company that all of a sudden is shifted into tank mode.
Yes.
And you're working on pieces of tanks.
Yes, you couldn't even get a metal box spring for a mattress set or any springs like that until after the war.
And you said before that this was very fulfilling for you. You felt like you were doing your part to help your country.
Yes, I really did. We had scrap drives at school where we took trucks out and picked up all kinds of metal, old car bodies and so forth. And it was just everybody. Everybody was in the war effort.
Mm-hmm.
There was no opposition, hardly at all, if any.
So you continue on. You said you're junior class president?
Yes.
This was Peoria High School?
This was at East Peoria Community High School.
All right. And so you're junior class president. You're playing sports. You're working at the Caterpillar factory. When did you start to think that the Marine Corps was going to be a good fit for you?
It wasn't just seeing a movie picture. I felt a duty. I felt that I really belonged in service at that time because I was strong physically, and I thought I was probably as good as any sailor or soldier that was in there. I had an older brother. He was already in the Army Air Corps at that time. And my father being a veteran of World War I, we were a very patriotic family. There was just no doubt about us. I enlisted at 17 with my father's signature.
And obviously with his blessing. What were your expectations? Did you think you knew what it meant to be a Marine?
I thought I did going in, but I was wrong.
What was the biggest wake-up call for you?
Biggest wake-up call when I got to Las Vegas and they took all my clothes away from me, and all of a sudden, well, you were really a lowly peon. You were there to learn, and they were going to teach you how to learn, and they were in complete control of your life.
I guess so. And here you are 70 years later back in Las Vegas. Go figure.
That's right.
And I bet you didn't expect, when you joined the Marine Corps, that your time overseas was going to be spent on a ship and not hitting the beaches.
Had no idea.
So how did it come about that you became assigned to the USS Colorado, a decorated World War II battleship?
Each platoon that graduated from the San Diego Recruit Depot, there was one person chosen for sea school, and I was that person. I don't know what all the qualifications were, but you had to have a decent IQ. After sea school, I was in San Diego when President Roosevelt came in his private railroad car and made two addresses. The last one was at Coronado. And from San Diego, he had a fireside chat with the American public. I stood presidential guard duty and relieved some of the Social Security men so they could rest and eat and get some decent food from the Marine Corps base. But I got to see the president. I didn't get to meet him. I met Fala, his Scottish dog. And shook his paw. It was quite a meeting. From there, Roosevelt went on to Pearl Harbor, where he boarded a cruiser to go there. He didn't fly. And then he went back to Seattle. In the meantime, I went to Bremerton by Seattle and was put aboard the Colorado. It just came back from 10 a.m., and it was pretty well shot up. They lost quite a few Marines.
Yeah, I've read about that at Tinian, it did suffer 22 shell hits and had 43 men killed during that battle in late July. But I want to ask some more questions about this deal in San Diego. You're, 17, maybe not quite 18 years old, and you're guarding the President of the United States?
I am, with a M1 rifle. I'll tell you this, but no one will probably believe it, but we train not only with that, but with a Rising semi-automatic, with a sawed-off 12-gauge shotgun for anti-riot control, and the 45. Besides our M1, we stood guard basically with the 45 and the M1.
And when you talk about that training with the sawed-off shotgun, this is specific to having to guard the president? That wasn't your general Marine Corps training. That was for that specific duty. Is that right?
That's right. That's the only thing it was for.
Yeah, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. What did that feel like? What did that make you feel important? Was that a heavy burden on you to be partly responsible for the safety and security of the leader of the free world?
No, it wasn't a burden. I accepted it freely because I was such a good rifleman and such a good shot that I was ready to protect him no matter what.
Is that a pretty tense duty? I mean, are you on edge waiting for something to happen?
You're alert, but you're not on edge. Mm-hmm. You're alert.
You probably need to stay calm in order to carry out your duties.
That's right. And you weren't to be reckless and go halfway off or so forth. You had to have a reason to do any defensive shooting or anything. But we had live ammunition, and we were told to shoot to kill.
Just don't shoot that dog.
That's right.
And I'm sure if anyone has been to Washington, D.C. and seen the Franklin Delano Roosevelt Memorial, they know that Falla is part of that memorial.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's a bronze dog right there next to FDR in his wheelchair.
I'll be darned.
So maybe you can go have a reunion. So you go up to Bremerton, you get aboard the Colorado, and this is a big battleship that's already scarred by World War II. Was that an adjustment for you to become part of the crew of that ship?
It was. I realized that I was taking the place of a dead Marine, and number one 20-millimeter anti-aircraft gun is my position. I was the gunner, and I had a crew of two. The three of us were very bonded together. We were very good. I was looking forward to getting into action because we were so well trained and we were so battle ready. We had knocked down flags that were drug past us with the cable holding a big cloth. We were just so good at everything that we knew we were ready.
And it didn't take you long to see action, and it didn't take you long to get hurt.
It was much quicker than I realized because it was our first engagement in Lady Gulf that we got hit by the two planes.
Tell me what happened. What do you remember about that day?
I remember we were on alert and that there were planes coming in to attack our fleet. They expect them to approach from the rear of our ship because they had the structure of every ship and so forth, and they knew that was the best way to approach our ship with less fire. Fortunately, I was able to train my gun to fire back there, but I was the only one out of the five that could shoot back aft like that.
So only one of the guns was able to shoot toward the rear of the ship.
Out of the five in our tub.
This is 1944. The kamikazes weren't hot and heavy yet like they would be by the end of your tour when you were at Okinawa. Had you heard of this idea of a suicide plane attack before you went into that battle?
No.
So this is a completely new idea.
I was a teenager at that time, still in love with my hometown, even though I was in the Marine Corps.
So this is a pretty eye-opening experience at Lady Gulf. You're on a 20-millimeter gun?
Yes.
Your job is to shoot down airplanes?
Yes.
And the airplanes are coming?
And they're coming.
So what happened next?
The two planes that came in to our fantail, one we hit, whether I hit it or not, I don't know, and it just barely got aboard the ship. The second one, though, hit in a casemate on the opposite side of the ship. As it came in, why, it went farther to its left and hit right below our quad 40-millimeter count on that side of the ship.
It occurs to me that a lot of people listening have never been on a 20-millimeter mount on a battleship before, and they might not know how you operated that firepower. What was your technique? If you see a plane coming toward your ship, where are you aiming to try to knock it out of the sky? Because you don't want to knock it into your own ship either, I'm sure.
Well, you want to hit the plane regardless, which is very difficult. And if it still hits you, why, that's just fate. But you had a special sight, and the sight was very good once you trained on the plane. It allowed for the lead, and also through the sight, you could see your tracer bullets. We loaded in the magazine which was 60 shells, we loaded 20 to 25 tracer bullets so that we could see where our shells were going. And, of course, everything was real quick, but the sight was very good. It allowed for lagging right away, and you were on target.
And I imagine a big part of that is a feel, huh? I mean, you have that feel for how fast that plane's moving, how far you need to lead it. You're watching that tracer.
With experience, you develop that feel. You don't have it at first.
Sure.
But as you get used to it, because the planes are faster than the targets that you trained on.
Mm-hmm.
And they're coming directly toward you.
And this is the very first time you've ever fired this weapon in combat.
That's right.
And two planes are coming right at your ship.
That's right.
We need to catch a break, but when we come back, we'll hear how that worked out for a then 18-year-old Marine. For photos and even a brief video with today's guest, Harold Lowe, check out Hometown Heroes Radio on Facebook. We'll be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.